Today we welcome Tim Harris, a wonderfully quirky children's writer, author of award-winning books such as Painted Dogs and Doom Cakes from the Exploding Ending series, and most recently, Mr. Bambuckle's Remarkables, with the lead book being awarded a CBCA Notable in 2018. Presenter, ex-teacher, musician, and a man of many talents. I'm your host, Danny V.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Danny.
As a fellow teacher, I'm an educator myself. I want to start talking about your previous career. You were a primary teacher for 15 years before you became a writer. Tell us about the transition from teacher to writer.
Yeah, 15 years. It's funny, you know, like it sounds like a long time, but really I felt like I was still learning what to do in that 15th year. Yeah, look, teaching was a great job. I really enjoyed it. And I think the thing I loved most about it was just that face-to-face you get with the kids. And I think the only thing that matched my passion for teaching was my dislike of administration. So, yes, that's not a fun thing, all the paperwork. And so the first 10 years, actually, of my teaching, I had my big creative outlet was songwriting. So I'd played in a few bands, I'd written and recorded a couple of albums, and almost had a big breakthrough in the music career with one of my songs being down to the final two for a scene in Grey's Anatomy. So I think if that had gone through, then I probably wouldn't have ever even tried story writing. Then when our first child came along in my 11th year of teaching, all of a sudden gigging music was just way too hard just to keep doing it. You'd come home at midnight from a gig and baby would be up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's just impossible to keep that up. So I sort of hung up the keyboard, so to speak, sold it on eBay. Actually, that's what hung up the keyboard meant. And then just enjoyed being a parent, and trying to get through those first few sleepless months. But then that creative passion came back and I thought, I had this really great class of year one boys. I was teaching in a boys' school and I thought, what can I give them for Christmas? You know, I could give them some chocolate or do the usual thing. And I thought, I might write them a story. One of the boys in that class, whose mum was involved in the children's book counts, and she got a hold of the story and was super encouraging. So the transition happened by accident. I'd written this story as a gift. It had gotten to the hands of a parent who knew a thing or two about writing, and she said, Tim, you should really work on this because you've got some talent. And she said, there's lots of, you're very raw, there's lots of errors and things, and I knew that. And so she came in, gave up her time and gave me a whole lot of free workshops, and that's how it all started.
That is an incredible story.
It's just such a lovely string of coincidences. So the transition by accident, and then so I self-published for a few years, and then landed a publishing deal with Harbour Publishing, a South Coast-based publisher in New South Wales, and they started doing Exploding Endings. I said to them after the first book, I initially self-published four in that particular series. They were keen on the four of them. I said, if we can schedule for two next year, I'll dedicate myself to school visits. So they said, you're on, and that's how it all started.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I have so many questions now just from what you just said. First of all, you are certainly not the only person to complain about the admin of teaching, because all teachers want to do is actually teach, and you've got all this stuff to do. So, yes, you're not alone in that.
the thing that I get frustrated, it's got to be done, 2018, it's just got to be done, but it just takes so much energy away from the stuff that I should say really matters, but that planning, the lessons and the energy that goes into face-to-face teaching, and it's just sad that a lot of time and energy gets put elsewhere.
And talking about songwriting and book writing, I did see your collection of vinyls on your blog, which very nice, I must say. We're a similar vintage, so I recognise the vinyls. What parallels did you find between songwriting and story writing?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. With songwriting, for me, it was always music first. So I'd muck around with chords and melodies and sort of find a mood, and then the lyrics would come next. But, of course, with writing, it's got to be words on a page, as first and foremost. So I think with music, I guess I could take my time a lot more with songs, because it'll be sitting on that melody or that chord progression, and then waiting for the right lyrics to come along. But with stories, it was very much a case of this, you know, a story has to start quite quickly, in terms of you want to grab that reader with an interesting start, or, you know, a sizzling start, as, you know, the teachers teach little kids. And so I found that I couldn't, this is like a personal thing, I couldn't really sit on an idea too long. I just had to sort of start doing it, to feel that I was progressing. And sometimes that would mean, you know, rewriting 1,000 words or completely scrapping something, but that was the way to get the feel for a story, was actually just to start writing. Yeah, and I've heard a lot of people say there's no wasted words, even the ones that you delete aren't wasted, and I think that's very true. But in songwriting, I don't know. Yeah, perhaps there's wasted words, but for me it was all about that, yeah, capturing that mood early on. I think they're two quite different things.
Yeah, and I think you're right about that, because I read somewhere that you have to write 1,000,000 bad words before you can write good words, and I thought, oh, that is so many words. Mr. Bambuckle is a wonderfully quirky teacher in the Remarkable series, and he is inspired by real-life teachers, and I love on your blog that you credit 5 teachers for inspiring him, both teachers who taught you and colleagues. What a wonderful tribute to the profession.
Yeah, that was a nice thing to do. And I think the thing that I really loved about teaching, and, you know, I started really young, so I think I was 21 when I had my first class. I'd gone straight from high school to uni and straight into a job in a private school. So it was, you know, I didn't feel the pressure, but because I felt very supported. But what teachers do so well is they share ideas. And so by having great colleagues around who are doing all these wonderful things, it kind of, you get to pick and choose what you want to start doing yourself. And in the end, you become a unique teacher, but you get shaped by those around you. And so Mr. Bambuckle is definitely shaped by some of, you know, on that blog, it was 5 teachers, 4 of them being former colleagues and 1 being a former teacher. Yeah, and that's the fun thing about writing as well, is you can really take a character wherever you want. So, you know, one teacher I worked with did these amazing projects with his students, you know, painting cars and working on the engines and building incredible things. So I thought, you know, well, Mr. Bambuckle, you know, he can build drones with the kids, and looking at my drone story in that way. So I really think, you know, it was nice to be able to do that blog post and send it to those teachers, just to let them know, you know, keep up the brilliant work that you're doing, because, you know, it makes a real impact, not only with the students, but also with other teachers.
Yeah, I found that so nice, that blog, and also saying what those teachers did, you know, taking kids out of their comfort zones, stretching their imaginations, etc. I thought that was such a nice thing.
My second year of teaching, and in the end I became quite good friends with his parents, but we went to have swimming lessons on a Friday afternoon. This is year 2 kids, so pretty young, like 8 or 9 years old, and this is back before OH&S became super tight. So anyway, we've come back from school after swimming, and it's Friday afternoon, and, you know, you don't think to sort of mark the roll like you do first thing in the morning, and finally the bell goes, and suddenly this parent rocks up to collect her son, and I'm thinking, oh, shivers, actually I haven't seen him all afternoon. Oh, hang on a second. He might be at the pool. He'd lost his swimmers and he got really scared, and he locked himself in the bathrooms at the swimming pool. And so we were frantically, you know, calling the swimming pool. They went and sent someone in the toilets, and they found him, you know, cowering in this locked cubicle because he was scared he was going to get in trouble for forgetting his swimmers. And 2 hours later at school, we picked it up. So, yes, of course, you know, that's the sort of thing you think, oh, shivers, I'm going to get 7,000 negative emails now. And it was quite nice that in the end, you know, it was a good relationship with that family.
And thank you for telling me my worst nightmare. My son's just started school, and now that is now my worst nightmare. So thank you for that.
You're going to get a note, Daniel. It'll be like, you know, do you give your son permission for swimming lessons?
Nope.
No.
I've heard stories. He's not going anywhere. And look, my own English teacher, and that was a really long time ago. I was at school, but he is still one of my greatest inspirations. So it's so nice that you've, you know, given that wonderful tribute to the profession, and, you know, you've obviously made such an impact yourself. Even though Mr. Bambuckle is quirky and he's funny and absurd, the book does deal with serious issues, such as ensuring you take kids out of their comfort zones and stretching their imaginations, engaging students and calming their insecurities and making them feel special. And Mr. Bambuckle is all of these things. Was he kind of the ideal teacher in your mind?
I think so. It's funny, you know, because he, out of all the characters I've ever written, and usually my short stories, certainly in the Exploding Ending series, they're all very self-contained, so you don't get to know the characters too well. But because he's the central, you know, character of the series, he's therefore the one I'm invested in most. But he's actually been the character I've least planned. By deliberately making him unpredictable, my process is with him, I'll plan the short stories and the children's stories, but the narrative where Mr. Van Buckle is with the class, I don't plan that so much because I don't know what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. And so the kid, you know, dialogue might form or something might start happening in the classroom quite naturally. And then my process for Mr. Van Buckle is, you know, what would I do, and then okay, well, Mr. Van Buckle's going to do the complete opposite. But by being consistent with that, you start to build up a bit of a consistent character, because he's always unpredictable, but in a very positive way, because he's, you know, he's very much students first. How can I get the best out of the students? But yeah, in a very quirky and unplanned way.
I wanted to employ him and work with him, I must admit.
Have you got a fry pan, Danny? You can start cooking some bacon and eggs.
Well, not a self-eating one.
Even things like that. That was just completely unplanned, and all of a sudden it was on the front cover. So,
I imagine I would be popular with the high school kids if I started cooking up bacon in class.
Oh, that's great.
It was so lovely to read about the kids and how he changed them. So, you know, you had these different little stories of each of the children in his class, and then they told this story, and then he just sort of went, well, you know, and brought them out of their comfort zone, and just you saw the change in them. I thought, how nice. And it was just a real example of how the impact that teachers can make.
Teachers can definitely make a big impact, and it does work both ways as well. Students can really impact the teacher. And I think the thing that I really miss about teaching is it's those classroom relationships. You know, I was joking about the paperwork before, but in seriousness like that, I found that really hard, and it wasn't enjoyable at all. But the thing that kept going for that time was those classroom relationships. So I missed them. And so in a way, the 15 students in his class sort of, I felt like they became a class, you know, my own little class again. And so because I sort of tried to write with that frame of mind, therefore I felt I wanted them to change for the better as well. And of course Mr. Van Buckle is the character to do that. So each of the, you know, each of those kids, so Evie, for example, with the washing machine, that, you know, that was just this really silly concept. For a couple of years I'd had this concept about someone who gets attacked by a washing machine. That was stupid, very silly, but of course you know, Evie changes and she becomes a little bit braver. And so with her being the focus of that story, it suddenly gave it, I guess, an extra layer. So it wasn't just the really sort of whimsical, silly, ridiculous concept story. It had that extra element. And that was a nice thing to do. And again, as I mentioned, you know, I felt this, you know, this is my little class now. I get to work with them and see what they're all like and how they can change. And it makes the writing process, I think, really quite enjoyable.
I really liked the washing machine. I thought it was crazy, and I thought kids would love it. You want reading to be fun. You want books to be able to reach those kids who are reluctant readers. So I thought the washing machine was great.
I'm pleased to hear that. Yeah, and that is, I guess, the result of one of those what if questions. You know, I was listening to the interview you did with Jules Favor, and you often hear him saying, you know, what if this happens, and it opens up so many possibilities.
Yeah, it does. Jules was great. I love chatting to him. He's such a funny guy.
he's a classic.
I always see the banter on Twitter with you guys.
I'm hopeless at Twitter. I just don't know what I'm doing there. I've actually decided to turn off notifications and just check in every now and then, because it ends up, Twitter for me is now, it's like, it should be called banter.
I like
and
that.
Instagram is more sort of orthogram.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I don't think anyone knows what they're doing on Twitter, just quietly.
And I think they, like, increase the characters.
Yeah, I know.
Because it used to be, what, 125 or something?
Yeah, now it's heaps. I just keep typing and I'm like, oh, they're still letting me type.
I wonder if they'll just keep increasing it. I don't know.
You'll be able to write your novels on Twitter soon.
Yeah, that's right. Because there wasn't there that little craze a while ago where people were writing short stories on Twitter, and then it became published in a book.
That sounds awesome.
It was like all these stories are really, really short stories.
Uh-huh. I'll have to dig them up. They sound great. Now, did you ever teach a Vex Vron?
Vex. Good old Vex Fromm. I didn't teach a Vex Fromm, but that's a bit of, you know, classic alliteration with Vex then. I didn't. But he, yeah, most of the kids were inspired by children I actually taught. But Vex was, he was just a, he had to be completely, you know, fashioned as a brand new character. I didn't, but I just wanted to have a student, I guess a pet project for the teacher who changes a lot slower than the other students because he's, you know, very nasty in book one, but it slowly starts to change as the series progresses. But what do you think of his name? Because I thought I'm quite proud of that name because it just sounds bad.
It does. I loved it. I loved it. And I didn't see him as nasty. I saw him as spirited. And you said as an author, you still get to have that contact with kids. And besides the relationships, what else was it that you loved and you still love working with young people?
I think I do. There's a certain innocence with primary school children that I really enjoy and just that sense of wonder. And I think one of the things I enjoyed most about teaching was the shared reading. And I really loved just Paul Jennings was my go-to, but I also enjoyed speaking to the librarian and saying, you know, what should I read with my class? What, you know, what covers certain issues? And librarians are so good like that. They're just a wealth of information. And so that wonder that the children had with story and just enjoying reading to them and discussing the characters and the issues and those sorts of things at that age of innocence was quite a lovely thing. And so I think now I sort of get my fix of that, but quite fortunate in that I get to share my own stories, but still, you know, enjoying that sense of wonder. I probably should. I know a lot of authors do. I think Tristan Banks is really good at doing it. He sort of tests ideas out with his audiences, and I reckon that would be a great thing to do. I just don't know how to do it, though. I think I prefer testing. I prefer sort of sharing tried and tested ideas. But yeah, I reckon that would be really fun just to get that all those possibilities. What ifs and enjoying that age of wonder and what they have to say about new ideas.
Yeah, and that's a crazy idea, isn't it? But isn't that great? Because kids are so full of imagination. And like you say, you know, they're not worried about the realism of the washing machine. You know, they don't care about that. They just care about the fun and the joy and the absurd. So that's a really cool idea that you're saying Tristan Banks does.
Yeah, that's right. I think for his My Life series, I'm pretty sure in the back of one of them, he sort of thanks about 150 schools or something and a huge amount of schools where he literally tested ideas and refined ideas and then they made their way into the book. So, yeah, I reckon it'd be fun. Maybe I should start doing it.
That's
yeah.
Wonderful. You have to tell us how it goes.
Yeah.
Now, you've recently been recognised as a Children's Book Council of Australia Notable for 2018. How does it feel to have your work recognised in this way?
Oh, that was such a genuine surprise. We were in Adelaide doing the tour for the second book and to be honest, I was so always keep them up for the list because it's really great to see what's been recognised. But I was so sort of set in my mind that it just wouldn't happen that I forgot about the announcement date. And then all of a sudden my phone started going off with kind messages from friends. So it was a genuine surprise and a real thrill because, you know, you sort of, it's a really lovely recognition. And so today actually I was at the shortlist announcement, so it was really lovely to hear and support those authors who got into the shortlist. Mr. Van Buckle didn't, but that's I'm just more than happy with the Notable Award, and that just sort of was a really great start to the year. So it was just a really nice thing, and it's something that I'm very proudly, you know, tell my children about when they're old enough to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find the book community, readers, writers, they're just so supportive of each other as well.
Yeah, super supportive. And it's like I was saying with teachers, you know, teachers are very generous with their knowledge and sharing. And so is the book community, whether it's teacher librarians or booksellers or authors or publishers. There's a lot of goodwill in the Australian kidlit scene, and it's a warm, fuzzy place to be. That's why I eat lots of chocolate. I think we should talk about chocolate.
Excellent. I think it's a good segue.
It's such a forced segue, but we'll have to get there somehow. Yeah, so
we will.
When I get in a good mood, I just go for the chocolate. So, yeah, actually, I did. I celebrated. My publicist said, all right, it was time for lunch. And I said, can we go with somewhere with something sweet? She's like, yep. So I had waffles for lunch.
Nice. I was going to ask what your chocolate of preference is since we're going down this path.
Well, you were saying before we started the interview, you were saying lint
yeah,
balls?
Yeah, the black lint balls are my poison.
So that's the dark blue
wrappers? Yeah. They're the black wrappers. This is like 60 or 70% dark.
Oh, wow. So it's almost powder that you're eating.
Well, I've had to work my way up to it. I had to start with the blue, but now I'm really into the black. So what's yours?
Hags, little buttons. So Hags is in Adelaide. They're made in Adelaide. They've got a few shops in Melbourne and Adelaide and Sydney. They've got a couple now. But it's a really interesting story with Hags. Apparently Hags is a generation-by-generation family business, and it got to, like, the third generation, and they wanted to improve their chocolate quality. So the guy in charge of it flew to where's Lindt? Is that Switzerland?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, wherever Lindt is, he flew over there to Lindt and he made a deal. And so he came back to Australia with all this amazing chocolate knowledge. What a cool trade-off.
That is language a cool trade-off. For a skill. And I think when I went to Adelaide, I went on a chocolate tour at Hague's, I'm pretty sure. They have a little chocolate factory there.
Yeah, they do. They do. It's got all the glass windows and you can see them, you know, churning the and refining their chocolate balls and all that kind of thing. It's pretty cool.
See, I was there. I'm a chocolate fan too.
Awesome. Yeah, I eat way too much chocolate when I'm writing.
We'll just call this episode Chocolate and Books. What I really enjoyed were the illustrations in the book as well. And speaking to Jules about his work, you know, with the writers and how he works, do you just kind of let the illustrator go, in this case James Hart, or is it collaborative throughout the process? How do you end up sharing the same vision? Because I often thought that the illustrations, not only were they interesting, they really added to the story or the characterization.
Yeah, I agree. I think James is a really good fit. And so the process there was Penguin Random House, after reading the first draft, sort of started to work out which illustrator, you know, who's going to fit closest to that style. And so in the end, they settled with James, he's done a great range of books now. And I'm so glad they did, because I do think it's a good fit. And he's just such a talented artist. And the illustrations, as you said, they really capture the mood of the book. So he does his first sort of drafts of internal, and the publisher gives him some feedback and copies me in, and I get to have a bit of a say. To be honest, I was just so blown away with them. I think I just put a whole bunch of smiley faces over the feedback and sent it back in, and then there's, you know, a few small refinements. So I actually didn't get to meet him until well after book one had been, I think it'd been out in the shops for about 4 weeks.
Wow.
Before I got to meet him. So the end result I think is really nice, and James has done a brilliant job.
It's a really interesting way to work, isn't it? That indirect collaboration. I like it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it shows the importance of a publisher who knows what they're doing as well. And I guess it was nice just being able to completely step back and trust all that was going on behind the scenes, and then get those first drafts, and then, you know, a couple of little comments here or there and lots of smiley faces, and then see the final product. So, I'm really pleased that it worked out that way.
And the drawing of Mr. Bambuckle, especially on the front cover of the first book, is just beautiful. Like, I just love it.
It is lovely, isn't it? That sparkly jacket and the hair. And, I think that there are about maybe 11 versions of Mr. Bambuckle before we had settled on the final one. One of them looked a lot like Doctor Who. So we sort of thought, that's Tim. I can't remember which Doctor was. Tim Baker, I think. So we scrapped. That was the first one to go. But then he slowly evolved into the Bambuckle on the front cover.
Yeah, perfect, I think. You were saying, I was reading actually, that some of your books take 3 to 4 months to write. And you were saying before that Mr. Bambuckle, you really let him drive some of the story, even though you've plotted it out before. Is that your usual writing process, where you kind of have some idea and you let the characters take the story away?
Yeah, for Mr. Bambuckle's Remarkables, that was the case. For Exploding Endings, because they were all just the self-contained short stories, I guess it was a concept like very basically mapped out. In the end, it became a little bit sort of formula, which felt quite comfortable. It might be a simple situation with 3 or 4 mini complications, or as things get progressively worse for the main character, and then they get resolved. That had to get, mapped out, and then the students' individual stories got placed strategically where they would sort of help the main story progress. So I guess if someone's listening and they haven't read it, it's written in 3 different voices. There's the third person voice, which is telling the whole story, which stretches across the whole book. Then there's first person, which is the children's stories, and there's four of those in each book, so and they're about 3,000 words long. And then there's the silly voice, which is odds and ends and conversations with the canteen lady and, you know, children passing notes and that kind of thing as well. So they had to be meticulously plotted out to make sure that it worked in an order that wouldn't take away from the main story. And then after that, after the main sort of scaffold was there, then there was a bit of room for letting the scenes in the classroom unfold with Mr. Bambuckle's unpredictability.
I love that, how you don't even know where he's going to go. That's awesome.
It is fun. And it's certainly the most I've enjoyed writing a character for that very reason.
Now, you said you've been both self-published and traditionally published. What were the main challenges for being a self-published author when you began?
Yeah, it was a very steep learning curve. Probably the main challenge was editing, and I think I sort of jumped in a little bit too early with my first two exploding endings to the point where kids at school would be rushing up to me in the playground and say, "Oh, I found a typo on page 6. Oh, hey, I found one on 7 and 8. Page 23 to 35 is 13 consecutive typos." So there were errors everywhere. And so by that stage, I was a bit more confident that the stories were interesting, but I was really down on confidence in terms of just how to get this polished correctly, because my naive idea of editing as a self-published author was to get someone to check the typos. But of course, if that's all you're checking for, there's going to be missing a lot. So after that, I had some really good, honest feedback from James Roy indirectly. He visited a school just after I'd been there for book week, and the librarian was a good friend of mine, and she showed him one of my books, and he very honestly just said, you know, tell Tim he needs to get a good editor. And so once that happened, I sourced an editor in America, a freelancer through Elance, which is now upwork.com, and she was wonderful to work with. Her name was Jenny Bowman, and she structurally edited the stories, which I had no idea was a thing. So suddenly she's saying, you know, this character's not working, or you can't say that in a children's book, and all these things. And so I'm suddenly ripping it apart and tightening it up. And then when that happened, the difference in mindset, just in confidence with, oh, this is how you do it, that gave me the confidence to submit traditionally.
Yeah, it's funny. Most people who have been self-published have said that editing is the key thing. If you get that right, you're on your way.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And we got, for Exploding Innings 4, we got Sue Whiting to do it. And again, and that was an absolute blessing, because while Jenny was wonderful, just her being in America into Australia, but with Sue's knowledge of the Australian market was invaluable, and she ripped a couple of the stories to shreds, and that was hard. It was hard to hear, and it was hard to work through, but I was just so pleased with the result, and it prepared me for some of the edits that I'd have to do with Mr. Bambuckle 1 and 2 as well. And but I guess by that stage as well, you kind of learn not to take it personally. It's just a process.
And has that experience changed your writing now?
Definitely, yeah. I'm a big believer in that you never stop learning, and I love reading Australian authors, but I still feel like such a rookie in terms of how to write well. And so editors, they're like teachers. I've got a wonderful editor at Penguin Random House, Victoria Stone, and Zoe Walton as the publisher gives some suggestions as well. It's just a goldmine of knowledge, and I feel that it's just a dripping tap, but if you could turn it on, you could learn so much. So I'm a big believer in always learning, and I think we're blessed with lots of brilliant writers in Australia who, like that teaching thing I said earlier, where you pick up things here and there, it's very much the same with reading and writing. And I know that if I keep have a positive attitude with the learning, then I'll hopefully keep improving as an author as well.
And who are your literary influences throughout childhood and adulthood?
Yeah, childhood, love the Narnia series. I think that was just because it was just such great fantasy. My mum read those to me because she knew that I was a very reluctant reader, so she was patient and used to come in at night time and read chapters to me, so that was really good. Being a reluctant reader, Paul Jennings, when I was in year 5, sort of discovered him, and, you know, it's the sort of thing that you start running home from school to see around the twist on television. And I've been watching it with my kids, actually. It's so cool when you hear them getting ready for bedtime and they're going, have you ever felt like this? It's you know you're doing a good thing as a parent when that happens. Paul Jennings, really big hero. And for my 15 years of teaching, every single class was saturated with Paul Jennings stories, and we had an absolute blast reading those. And then, I guess when, probably a lot of the heroes evolved when I started writing. So, then you sort of start to latch on to other funny authors, trying to write funny stories. So it's natural that Andy Griffith's My Life series has been influential. And certainly Paul Jennings would be at the top of that influence pile.
What I think is so great is that you were a reluctant reader and then you've become a writer. Like, how amazing is that?
It's bizarre, isn't it? It really is. It just goes to show you that if you never stop learning, and who knows what sort of career. It's funny, at the schools I taught in, the curriculum, they use the PYP, the Primary Years Program, which is part of like the International Baccalaureates Program for junior school kids. And their big thing was that, kids are going into jobs that aren't invented yet. And so you've got to teach them to be learners for life. And I think that's true for anyone in any profession. There's I really didn't like reading as a boy. And to now become an author is such there's almost a nice irony. And I say that in schools as well when I do school visits. And I hope that it encourages those kids who are reluctant readers to go, if that can happen, you can learn. Maybe I should give it a bit of a go.
And I think that comes out in your writing too, because it is fun, it is crazy, it's not boring, and whether or not you're a reluctant reader, it would draw you into that story, because I think sometimes books are taken too seriously, but they can be fun and great and absurd,
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and the worst thing I want to be is a reluctant writer. Not get that fun across. No, that's 100% right. And it's nice seeing that range of books in a bookshop or in a library bookshelf. You want that broad variety of books, from the absurd and silly through the serious. And I think with the funny books, I think they're a really important stepping stone to get kids enjoying reading at an early age, and then they can start to explore the more serious books as they get a bit older.
And as a reader myself, I'm always reading, something serious, something historical, something funny, because it depends on what mood I'm in. All those books are really important.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I've read quite heavily in kid lit up until the last month, but now I'm on a bit of a YA burst. I'm actually just finishing up Mark Smith's The Road to Winter. Yep. I know you interviewed him recently, so I'm looking forward to listening to that. But it's a cracking read.
Isn't it?
It's so different, and it's sort of, it's very different to what I'm used to reading, but I'm absolutely loving it. And, and Will Kostakis, The Sidekicks, that was another one I read last year. And it sort of opened up this whole world of, read, you should enjoy reading more widely.
Yeah, and young adult fiction has just gone crazy in Australia, like everywhere, but particularly in Australia, it's just exploded. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's good to see, because I know that age group's tricky because they're not huge sort of book buyers, and life gets busy when you're a teenager and you start to, there's a lot of interest that can flood your life and social media and all sorts of things. So I'm pleased that there's a nice hum happening in Australia.
Yeah, and now there's such a broad selection of texts that kids, there has to be something that they want to read, because there's so much out there.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what's next for you? You've just finished the second book. The second book is out of Mr. Bambuckles. Is there a third, or what's next? What's happening for you?
Yeah, there is. So the third book is written. It's been structurally edited, and that was probably the hardest edit I've had to do, but I felt like I learned a lot finishing that up. So that is coming out in September this year, 2018. And so I'm really excited to introduce that into the world when the time comes. And I've just started drafting the fourth book in the series as well. And so I think the big discussion sort of to have with my publisher after that is what next, because after that fourth book, all the children in Mr. Bambuckle's class will have had their time in the sun. Drafting book four, I've got a pretty busy year with school visits. I think already close to 60 schools booked for this year, and it's only March, so I'll have to cap it eventually. But I've never said no unless the dates clashed, because I do enjoy getting out into schools. It's a big part of the job, and one that I really enjoy as well. A bit of school visits, and I'm hoping to possibly fly my eldest son down to Adelaide, not to just to go to Hague's, but to watch a bit of cricket. Although with cricket scandal going on, I don't know, we might give up on the Aussie team. Who knows?
I know, right? I went down to Adelaide to watch the cycling, and then there was all the whole, you know, cycling scandal as well.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I think just stay with the chocolate, stay away from the sport, can't go wrong.
Well, it sounds like stay away from Adelaide. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been so wonderful chatting with you and getting a real insight, not only to your previous career, obviously that's something I'm personally interested in, but, you know, your writing process in your novels and the great humour that goes into it. So thank you so much for your time. It's been really wonderful.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.